solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Every action you take is like a vote for the type of person you want to become. And so, in a sense, your habits are how you embody a particular identity. Like every time that you make your bed, you embody the identity of someone who's clean and organized. Every time that you make a healthy meal and cook that at home rather than eating out, you embody the identity of someone who is focused on eating healthy. Every time that you write one sentence, you embody the identity of a writer. And no, those little actions, those tiny habits do not radically transform your body overnight. They don't lead to a written book in a single day, but they do cast a vote for being that kind of person. And so early on, that's really powerful because those habits provide evidence of this new identity. They give you a reason to root that belief in something.
Hello, listeners. Happy New Year and welcome to the 52nd conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm an executive coach, and I help leaders play to their unique potential by helping them with the two questions, where to go and how to grow. These questions are quite parallel to the two questions businesses answer in the context of the business strategy, where to play and how to win. In this podcast series, I talk to leaders from multiple domains, CEOs, sportsmen, artists, thought leaders, and so on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. This is the time of the year where we make lofty goals for the year ahead and unravel the 2020 vision for our business and ourselves. And I thought it would be good for us to reflect on having a system that will ensure that we are able to achieve the goals that we set for ourselves. In that context, I'm excited to present my next conversation with James Clear, the author of the book Atomic Habits. He says, "You don't rise to the level of your goals. You fall to the level of your systems." Let me just pause for a second and let that sink in. You don't rise to the level of your goals. You fall to the level of your systems. I really learned a lot from this conversation, and I trust that you will find it purposeful too. Towards the end of the podcast, I share some thoughts on how we could share some of our stories around habits so that we could learn from each other and raise our game. Do listen on till the end to participate in this exercise. Without further ado, let's tune into my conversation with James Clear. James, really excited to have you at the Play to Potential podcast. Thanks so much for making the time.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me on. It's nice to talk to you.
Maybe before we dive into the specific, James, about Atomic Habits, I'd love to get a sense of how you got here. Tell us a little bit about the why behind the what you do.
Sure. So I sort of came to this topic through two different ways. One is personal and one professional. On the personal side, I played sports while I was growing up and ended up suffering this serious injury when I was in high school. I was hit in the face with a baseball bat. And the fallout from that injury was significant and extended. You know, it took 8 or 9 months for me to recover. I wasn't able to drive a car for that time. I was practicing basic motor patterns like walking in a straight line when I was at my first physical therapy sessions. Mm-hmm. And it was a period in my life where I was forced to start small. It was the first time where I didn't really have a choice. You know, I couldn't like try to attack a habit in a bigger way. And so I started focusing on small things like going to bed at the same hour each night or preparing for class for an hour each day. This is the first time in my life when I went to the gym consistently, first once or twice a week and then 3 or 4 times. Mm-hmm. And individually, those habits don't really sound very significant, but collectively, they gave me a sense of control over my life again. And I was able to kind of continue those habits and follow that arc. And I didn't get to play very much in high school, but I did make a college team and continued to progress throughout university and ultimately felt like I was able to make the most of the potential that I had as a player and ended up being named the Academic All-America team, which is about 30 players around the country are on that team. Mm-hmm. And so I had this personal side that I had been exposed to small habits. And then there was a more professional side. So I studied science in undergrad, mostly hard sciences, chemistry, physics, biology. And then I went to business school and got a graduate degree. And afterward, I started my own business. And for the first 2 years, I tried things, but just kind of flopped around and didn't really make much progress. Mm-hmm. And I realized that one of the reasons I was struggling was because I didn't understand how to market anything. I didn't know, like, why would somebody buy a product or sign up for an email list, or basically, why do customers take action? And so I started studying consumer psychology to see if I could improve my business in some way. And that started to naturally uncover and reveal some ideas around behavioral psychology and habit formation. And the more that I read about that, the more that those two sides of habits, my personal side and experience as an athlete, and then my professional side and interest in science, started to merge. So I started to be interested in the science of how habits form and the biology and neuroscience of how they work, what regions of the brain are involved. And the more that I studied those topics, the more I started to see, oh, I could actually use some of those ideas and apply them to my current weightlifting habits or diet habits or creativity habits. And mm-hmm. those were ideas that I had used when I was an athlete and so on. And I think that kind of summarizes where I'm at now and the role that my work sort of plays, which is my articles and certainly Atomic Habits. When I wrote the book, I want to be a bridge between academic research and practical application. And so I kind of view that as my job, to take scientifically grounded ideas about how habits work and how behavior changes, and then distill that in some way that we can use in a practical sense. Well, how do I actually use this in my daily life and work? And so that's kind of how I came to the writing and work that I do now.
Got it. And we'll get to the specifics of some of the things you say about how to build habits and break habits. But one of the things I really liked in the book, given that I'm curious about transitions, is you say that you work hard on the things that come easy, right? You go on to say that a good player works hard to win the game that others are playing. A great player creates a new game that favors their strengths and avoids their weaknesses. Say more about the crux of the insight here, James.
So this passage comes from a chapter where I talk about the influence of genes and personality on habits and behavior. And the basic idea is that we all have a certain set of strengths. There's some unique combination of strengths and weaknesses that make up each of us. And you can't control the genes that you were handed or the cards that you were dealt, but you can control kind of how you play those cards or what game you choose to play. And so as much as possible, you want to play games where the odds are in your favor, where you're more likely to be able to succeed. Now, this can mean a couple different things. First, in sort of like the personality sense, they're the most robust measure of personality is what psychologists call the Big Five. So it measures personality in five spectrums. The one that mm-hmm. people are most familiar with is introversion on one side, extroversion on the other. But there are a variety of others, openness to experience, conscientiousness, et cetera. And for some of these, for all five of these spectrums, they've been linked to the underlying genetic code in some way. There's some connection between your DNA and that personality. And so as an example, people who are high in agreeableness, which is one of the spectrums, tend to be warm and kind and considerate. And then you can imagine that if someone's personality is that they're high in agreeableness, so they're warm and kind, and maybe they're also high in extroversion, well, it might be much easier for them to build a habit like writing thank you cards or organizing social gatherings and getting people together after work, things like that, because it aligns more with their natural skill set. And so the first step in this, I think, is raising self-awareness. Once you can become more aware of who you are, what your strengths are, what you're kind of naturally inclined to do, you can start to seek out habits, behaviors, games, where it's more likely that you'll be able to succeed in that realm. So that's kind of the core idea. And then the big takeaway, I think, is that a lot of the time people don't like talking about genes or DNA or, your biological inclinations, because they feel like, oh, well, if it's in my genetic code, then like, why bother? It must be fixed. But I don't think that's the right lesson to take from this. I think instead the lesson is your genes don't tell you not to work hard. What they tell you is where to work hard. They don't say it doesn't matter what your strategy is because it's just destiny. Instead, they inform your strategy. And so by having better self-awareness, you can develop a better strategy to work for you and your goals.
Got it. And just picking on that, James, is there something to be said about when we have clarity on these things? I was talking to Herminia Ibarra, who's a professor at London Business School, who's written the book Working Identity. And she talks about transitions and sort of really wayfinding your way into something else. So on the things that come easy, how challenging or straightforward is it for people to figure that out as they think about where they want to build the habits?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think anybody has a perfect answer to this, but there are a couple things that you can look for. So the first thing that you can do is, and this is something I reference in the book as well, the basic idea is called the explore-exploit trade-off. And so early on in any process, what you want to do is explore broadly. So you can do this as big of a level as you want or as small as a level. So like a big level would be, what should I do for my career? Well, perhaps for the first, say, 5 years or first decade, you actually explore kind of widely. Maybe you take a different job every 2 years. Maybe you try a few different industries, intern at a couple different places. But the idea here is to develop a range of experiences. Maybe you're even in the same company, but you just change to different departments every few years. And so the idea here is to explore widely so that you can get exposure to a lot of possible paths. And then once you have that experience, then you can start to narrow and switch from explore to exploit, which is let me take advantage of the best option I know of now. And so that's kind of a big way to do that. We do this, for example, with relationships. This is the period of dating is what we call explore. And then once you decide to get married or commit to someone, then we're talking about exploiting the one relationship that works best for you. You can also do it, though, on a small scale. So, for example, let's say you have a project and you have 6 weeks to complete it. Well, for the first week or two, maybe actually you brainstorm a bunch of different ways to attack the project. You research a lot of potential options. But then as you get closer and closer to the deadline, now it starts to become more urgent that you actually get it done. And so rather than always looking for a better solution, you just commit to the solution that you are closest to at that point. And so there are kind of two ways to make that distinction. The one is how close am I to the deadline? How close am I to like needing to get a result now? And if you're getting closer, then it's like, well, maybe I should just focus on the best solution that I found. The other way to do this, though, is that the more that you're getting results, the more you should exploit the option that you have. And the less that you're getting results, the more you should explore for other options. And that is, again, it's hard to describe this and what exactly you should do for any individual, but people kind of implicitly know what that feels like. Like, for example, when I started my business, I started 3 or 4 different websites for the first 2 years, and they all went okay, but none of them really did well. And then when I started jamesclear.com, I was about a little over 2 years in, and it just went better. I was writing about habits and behavior change for the first time. Previously, I'd been trying a bunch of other things related to business and marketing. And when I started writing about that, the audience just took off much faster than usual. And so while it's hard for me to describe exactly what that should feel like for you, if you are trying a variety of things, you will know when the results are coming easier. And that's one of the good pieces of advice that I got early on was try things until something comes easily. And it doesn't mean that it's easy in the sense that you barely have to put any effort in, but it does mean that the results come much easier than the other things that you have tried.
Got it. And just moving on to another thing that you explain in the book, James, you talk about one of the investors, Paul Graham, and you refer to his quote, "Keep your identity small." You go on to say that the more you let a single belief define you, the less capable you are of adapting when life challenges you. I found that really thought-provoking. So talk to us about the insight here and how it links with building or breaking habits.
Yeah. So I think identity is a huge factor in life, but also particularly tied to our habits. So let's think about this from a big picture level first. So you have identities that can build you up. For example, like I'm the type of person who reads a lot, or I'm the type of person who finishes workouts, or I'm the type of person who finishes when I start. And then you also have identities that hold you back. So, you know, something like I'm terrible with directions, or I'm bad at remembering people's names, or I have a sweet tooth, or I'm bad at math. And we are all a collection of identities. Like, they're all multiple things that are part of you. Like, you might say, I'm a dad and a brother and a neighbor and a volunteer and a teacher or whatever. And, but it's not just labels that are part of your identity, like dad and teacher and friend and neighbor. It's also those internal beliefs, that narrative that you assign to yourself. And the more that you let one of those beliefs take over your entire identity, or kind of occupy too large of a portion, the more that you are fragile or brittle in that way. Because if you lose that one thing, then it feels like you lose your whole self. So as an example, you often hear this with people who are in the military. They might define themselves, part of their identity might be, I'm a soldier, right? I'm a good soldier. And then once they leave the military, suddenly they're not that anymore. And so there's this like loss of identity. There's this sense of self that they feel like they lose. On a similar level, I felt that when I stopped playing sports. For like 20 years, a big part of my identity was I am an athlete. And then all of a sudden, 1 year, that was the final time I played. And then I wake up the next day and what, am I not an athlete anymore? That's like who I was defining myself as. Hmm. And so I think one way to get around this is that you can focus on the more enduring aspects of a particular identity that you can take with you or carry with you into a new context. So, for example, in the soldier's case, they could say, well, rather than assigning the identity, I'm a soldier, I could assign identities like I'm reliable, or I'm a good teammate, or I have the back of those around me. Well, that's something, even once you're not a soldier, you can come back into the workforce or go to a business, you can still be reliable and be a good teammate and so on. Same way for athletes, they could say something like, you know, I'm the type of person who trains my body hard, or I'm consistent and show up to work each day. And like, you can do those things as an athlete, you can do those things as an individual. So mm-hmm. part of that is the separating of the identity, or the defining it in a better way. But the other aspect of this, and this is the part that you referenced with Paul Graham's quote, keep your identity small, is that the tighter you cling to any individual identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond it. So you see this in pretty much any area of life. The tighter you cling to the idea that, you know, like a teacher who's been teaching for 20 years and they have their lesson plans figured out, and it's like, this is the way it is. The tighter you cling to that, the harder it becomes to grow beyond that, learn new, different learning methods, new learning modalities, change your course structure, et cetera. The surgeon who is like, this is the way we do the operation, even though there might be a new technology that allows them to do it in a less invasive manner. The tighter you cling to that previous identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond it. And this is one of the real challenges for building habits, which is that early on, building a new identity is a really valuable thing because it can get you to stick to the habit. So, for example, let's say that you're not fit right now, but you want to mm-hmm. start getting in shape. Building the identity of I am a runner is a really valuable way to get you to stick to the habit of running. But then what happens, you know, 20 years from now, if you injure your knee or your hip and it's not possible for you to run anymore? Well, now you feel like, yeah, you've lost this sense of self. And so you need to transition to a new identity. And so the process here is not like a line. It's much more like a circle. You're continually evolving, continually updating and expanding and revising your beliefs. And you really need to be committed to doing that. And if you can keep your identity small, it makes that process easier. Because you're it's like retouching a painting. If your identity is so large that it consumes everything about you, then all of a sudden getting rid of that aspect feels like you're, you know, tearing yourself in two. And so for all of those reasons, keeping your identity small can be a valuable way to continue to grow, evolve, and expand.
Got it. No, it reminds me of a term in the that's often used in the context of, I've come across that in the context of Buddhism, which is attachment yet detachment. So it's interesting you talking about identity as something that's helpful at some levels, but at the same time, being too attached to it at the same time can be a constraint later on. So it's interesting the way you phrase it.
Yeah, and you can think of your habits as, I think this is one of the ultimate reasons that habits really matter. Like we often talk about habits as the pathway to getting external results. So you might say something like, oh yeah, build better habits and you can get six pack abs or lose weight or double your income or reduce stress. And it's true, habits can help you do all those things. But the real reason that habits matter is that they reinforce your desired identity. So every time that you perform a behavior, the way that I summarize this in the book is every action you take is like a vote for the type of person you want to become. And so, you know, in a sense, your habits are how you embody a particular identity. Like every time that you make your bed, you embody the identity of someone who's clean and organized. Every time that you make a healthy meal and cook that at home rather than eating out, you embody the identity of someone who is focused on eating healthy. Every time that you write one sentence, you embody the identity of a writer. And no, those little actions, those tiny habits do not radically transform your body overnight. They don't lead to a written book in a single day, but they do cast a vote for being that kind of person. And so early on, that's really powerful because those habits provide evidence of this new identity. They give you a reason to root that belief in something. And so it can be a very powerful thing to adopt a new identity. It can be very powerful to look at yourself in this new light. And habits, I think, are the best path to doing that. But years down the line, when it's time for another change or another upgrade, you also have to be willing to repeat the cycle again and continue to grow and evolve.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. When I work with leaders in transition, I often find that they attach surface-level labels to themselves, which is often either tied to one or more of three things. The profession, which is saying I'm a consultant or a banker or an investor. The industry. For instance, people say I work in financial services, healthcare or consumer. Or the function. People could say I'm a finance person, marketing person or an ops person. Building on what James says, there's often a different way of looking at ourselves. And sometimes this input can come from the outside. One of my guests in the podcast, Atul Kasbekar, spoke about how he transitioned from photography to producing movies, and he traces it back to a chat he had with a family friend who looked at him differently.
You know, I have a friend who's a spiritual guide. He lives in Bangalore, and he was saying that it's an excellent space for you because what you may not see is but what he sees, and it actually turned out to be quite true. He's saying, you know, you're actually a very habitable platform for people who otherwise would never meet each other to be pulled onto and to coexist and work in a harmonious way and be able to create.
There is an inverse correlation between the range of possibilities you consider when you're in transition and the identity you carry about yourself. And sometimes this new insight might come from the outside. Bearing that in mind would be of great help as you evaluate possibilities during your transition. One of the entrepreneurs I was working with came to me saying, I've spent 10-15 years building a business. I now have the opportunity of taking it from 100 to 300x with my brother. Or I could start something afresh and build something from scratch. Or maybe I could start a PE fund and mentor startups given my experience in the journey. Or I could take a break since I've had kids recently and spend time as a father for a while. I was speaking to one of his close friends from childhood on how I could help this leader because he was known to be a good problem solver and a strategic thinker. So I asked his friend, how can I really be of help to this leader with the question he's grappling with? And his response to me was, help him sort out his identity and he's smart enough to figure out the rest. Is he an entrepreneur, a husband, a father, a brother, a mentor or something else? Not that these are either or choices, but the point I want to make that especially when people are at crossroads, solving the identity is a key part of the equation without which we may not get to a meaningful answer. If this topic is of interest, you might like the book Working Identity by Herminia Ibarra, one of the leading thinkers in transitions. Herminia happened to be on the podcast a few episodes back, and here's a nugget from her.
These are people who have been very, very driven in careers that are very, very greedy, that take all. And so, you know, for a lot of us, we do have other anchors for identity and maybe things that we do outside the main day job. the more that main day job is a kind of like a monolithic thing that takes soul, the harder it is to extricate yourself. And then, you know, you start to see that it's not just the money, it's that that is your identity. And it is really scary to move beyond that.
You could specifically listen to The Nugget, transitioning from well-paying, time-greedy careers, where she speaks about such careers not just being time-consuming, but identity-consuming. You might also find the curated playlist on identity of interest. Now, let's get back to the conversation with James Clear. And just picking up on the thing you just said, James, you also say that progress is often exponential and not linear. And in a similar note, you talk about the notion of plateau of latent potential. Could you talk about these two themes in the context of how people think about habits and also the kind of feedback loops they set for themselves as they're building the habits?
Yeah, good question. So let's talk about the idea of compounding and exponential progress first. So I like to refer to habits as the compound interest of self-improvement. And what I mean is that the same way that money multiplies through compound interest, the effects of your habits multiply as you repeat them across time. And the challenging part of any compounding process is that the greatest returns are delayed. And so on day one or day 10 or day 30, you don't really have very much to show for your effort. The curve only takes off down the line once you hit that hockey stick portion, once it really takes off. And this is exactly what it feels like to build a new habit. You know, like, what is the difference on day one of eating a salad for lunch or eating a burger and fries? Not a whole lot. You know, like, your body looks the same in the mirror at the end of the night. The scale hasn't really changed. You don't really have anything to show for the effort that you're putting in. It's only 2 or 5 or 10 years later that you turn around and it's like, wow, those daily habits really do add up. And so in that way, building habits is kind of like this exponential curve. We think, oh, I'll put a little bit of work in and I'll get a little bit of results. So if I put a lot of work in, then I'll get a lot of results. But really, it's much more about time and letting it work for you. And just getting 1% better each day can count for something very significant in the long run. And so this is why I like to say, if you have good habits make time your ally. All you need is for time to work for you, for to let another day move by, and you continue to be put in a better and better position. But bad habits make time your enemy. Every day that clicks by, you're putting yourself a little bit further behind the eight ball. You're digging the hole a little bit deeper. And so for all of those reasons, I think habits are what we could say the compound interest of self-improvement. Now, the next step of this is what you're mentioning with the plateau of latent potential. And the basic idea here is this challenge that I just mentioned where the returns are delayed. You show up and you're not seeing the results that you want. And I like to summarize this by telling a brief little story, which is imagine that you walk into a room. It's cold. You can see your breath. Ice cube is sitting on the table. And you start to heat the room up slowly. You know, you're going to say, do you want to use Fahrenheit or Celsius? What would your audience get better?
Celsius is better.
Okay. All right. So let's say we're heating up this ice cube, right? And it's, I don't know, -5 degrees, something like that. You're heating it up, -4, -3, -2, -1. And the ice cube's still sitting there. You can still see your breath. But then you go from -1 to 0, and it's a 1 degree shift, just like all those that came before it. But suddenly the ice cube melts. You hit this phase transition. And the process of improving is very much like that. The process of building better habits and getting results is very much like the process of heating up an ice cube. And you hear people say things like this all the time. They'll say, like, I've been running for a month, but I can't see a change in my body, you know? And my argument is running for a month and complaining about not seeing the results you want, or writing your book for 8 months and not having it be finished yet. It's kind of like complaining about heating an ice cube from -5 to -1 degrees and they're not melting. You know, like, the work was not being wasted. It's just being stored. And so you can view each iteration of your habit as building up this potential energy that can then be released later on. And I think about, there's this quote from the San Antonio Spurs NBA basketball teams. They've won 5 championships and they have this quote hanging in their locker room. And it says something to the effect of, when I feel like giving up, I think about the stonecutter who takes his hammer and bangs on the stone 100 times without it showing a crack. And then on the 101st blow, it splits in two. And I know that it wasn't the 101st that did it, but all those that came before. And that is true for pretty much any habit, right? Like, it's not the final sentence that writes the book. It's all those that came before. It's not the latest workout that gets your body fit. It's all those that came before. And so the willingness to accept that 1% improvements make a meaningful difference, even if they don't show you anything on a given day, and then remaining committed to that in the long run, that I think is how you capture the power of compounding habits and of letting 1% improvements work for you rather than against you.
Got it. And if I may reconcile this with the point about working hard on the things that come easy and looking for where you're seeing success and really doubling down on it. At some level, I see a little bit of a paradox here, right? Where here you need to chip away at something and suddenly, you know, there's a phase transition where you see the outcomes. With that sort of a delay in knowing where you're seeing outcomes, how do you sort of relay that to the context of where you're trying to build habits? Do you see a little bit of a complexity there that we need to navigate through?
There's definitely a challenge with the speed at which you get feedback. So the faster you can get feedback, the more likely you are to stick to it. And actually, we could rephrase feedback a little bit to say the faster that you get signals of progress, the more that you get signals of progress, the more motivated you're going to feel to stick with it. If you don't have signals of progress, then it feels like you're just kind of stuck in this valley of death and spinning your wheels. And so there are a couple ways to overcome this. The first thing, and I have a chapter in the book where I talk about measurement and both the pros and cons of it, and how it can kind of work for you. But the first thing is you want to choose a measurement that delivers feedback at the right pace. Because if you get feedback too quickly, it's just kind of noise and you're like overreacting to everything. If you get feedback too slowly, then it takes too long and we run into the problem that you just mentioned, which is, well, you say you need to stick with it, but how do I know if this is actually working for me? How do I know if this is something that I'm, you know, inclined to be good at?
Yeah.
And so you can imagine, for example, let's take a workout. If you only measure the number on the scale, well, then that might actually be too slow because you might not actually change weight in any meaningful way until like over a 2-week span or something. If you measure, say, your blood glucose levels, that might be too fast, or your heart rate or your blood pressure, because it might change very rapidly during the workout. But if you do something like tracking your workout, like just put an X on the calendar each day that you swim or go for a run or lift weights, well, that like is feedback at the right pace, which is I showed up and I did the workout today. And so I can feel good about that. And seeing another X on the calendar is like a signal of progress that I'm building up this chain of habits, this chain of workouts. And so I'm not waiting too long and I'm not overreacting to something too short. But figuring out that measurement, that right pace, it might take a little bit of experimentation depending on the habit you're working on. But the point that you bring up is a really good one, which is we do face this challenge where in many fields, pretty much any field, persistence and reliability and consistency will get you better results. But along the way, you really need some signals of progress so that you can be sure that you're on the right path and not just repeating something that isn't going to pay off in the long run.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. How we think about setting up feedback loops during transition is a personal passion project of mine. Because when people are in transition, not only are they at the foothills of a compounding curve, they're also in a phase of identity vacuum, and they're keen to cling on to the first straw that comes their way. Professor Herminia Ibarra of London Business School, one of the leading thinkers in the space of transitions, speak about the notion of liminality, where she says that there's a phase where you're neither here nor there, and we need to be comfortable with trying a few things and letting it play out over a period of time before we pick something. She says that leaders often make a mistake of foreclosure or settling too soon for an option.
And so the two principles are, as you said, divergent exploration and delayed commitment. Divergent explorations is, what I mean by that is, whenever I teach people who are in transitions, one of the first things I do is I say, write a list of your possible selves. they don't have to be feasible, they don't have to be public, they don't have to be something you're committing to do, but just let your imagination run wild. What's the set of possibilities? Do a kind of brainstorming with yourself. Don't be embarrassed to write, even if it's ridiculous, put it in there. And it's really interesting what people come up with. It's quite, in fact, we are very multiple and often quite divergent. Doesn't mean you're going to do all of those things, and certainly not at the same time. But when you get permission to be divergent, there's a lot there. And in fact, one of the things that is hard for people in transition is they feel that they must not be ready because they're considering such a different array of options. And they feel that somehow that's wrong, that they are equally passionate and excited about two things that seem mutually exclusive, like getting promoted at my current firm and then starting up a business on something completely different. And one day you're excited about this and the other day you're excited about that and you think you're out of your mind. But in fact, what we're doing is trying to explore and compare and contrast and how do I feel here and how did I feel there? And so when you give yourself, and that's why it takes time, that's why the time factor plays in, to explore more divergently and say, this is actually natural. And it gives me more information so that then I can make the right choice. You make better decisions and you're less likely to do the other thing, the foreclosure, which is take the first thing that comes your way because it's been 6 months and I can't tell people anymore that I'm still, you know, out of work. So the delayed commitment comes from understanding that it's going to take time and you're not going to go for the first thing that comes up or the second thing until you really had a chance to test. Because once you jump, you're going to be stuck there at least another 2 years. And so why not take a little longer at the beginning in order to make a more robust choice?
As we think about compounding curves and latent potential, especially during transitions, it's critical that we don't measure the wrong thing too soon and look for outcomes which might take a longer period of time. A related point actually came up in my conversation with the stand-up comedian Papa CJ, who had an MBA from Oxford and was working as a management consultant. He speaks about his challenges in his early years of stand-up.
You know, I was possibly, not even possibly, I was the hardest working comedian in the UK. And normally there's 500 comedians competing for the same gig. I was the kind of guy who would go anywhere, anytime for no money. And a lot of the shows were outside London. So for example, I would leave London at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, drive to some city in the UK with a bunch of other comedians, do a show there. I was nervous, I wouldn't eat, probably couldn't afford food at that point. Drive back, get dropped off in the outskirts of London at 2 o'clock in the morning. I would pay the driver my share of petrol. I mean, keeping in mind, I wasn't getting paid for any of these shows. I would change 3 different buses to get back home and get home at about 4 o'clock in the morning. I did this every single day for an entire year. But at the end of that year, you have no money, no friends, no relationships, and no life. But every single comedy promoter in the country knows your name. That's where you start from.
In these situations, there's something to be said about measuring balance sheet metrics rather than P&L metrics. To take CJ's example, while he didn't have meaningful cash flows from the business in the first year, he had an asset of relationships with the ecosystem that he could build on and move forward. Now, let's get back to the conversation with James Clear. The other statement that you make in the book, which in a way captures the essence of the book, right? Which is you don't rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems. I thought that phrase pretty much captures the essence of the entire book. What's the insight here, James? And how do you see this playing out in organizations that you work with?
Yeah, so I think you're right. That's certainly one of the core themes of the book. And that phrase, we do not rise to the level of our goals, we fall to the level of our systems. What I'm really trying to get at with that is the distinction between our desired outcomes and our daily habits. Because a lot of the time, whether it's an individual or an organization that I work with, when they want to change their behavior, they often start by trying to set a larger goal. Double revenue this quarter, or I want to lose a certain amount of weight in the next 3 months, or whatever it is. And we think, well, if I just have bigger goals, if I try to take massive action, then I'll get these massive results. But the truth is, the goal is actually the easy part. And it's also fairly common among people in your particular industry to have the same goals. You know, like if 100 people apply for a job, presumably every candidate has the goal of getting the job. Or if 30 teams compete in the league for the same championship, presumably every team has the goal of winning the championship. And so if the winners and the losers in that domain have the same goals, the goal cannot be the thing that makes the difference. And that doesn't mean that goals are useless. Goals can be useful for setting a sense of direction, developing clarity, understanding where you want to focus. But once you understand that, once you understand where you want to allocate your attention and energy, it's useful to sort of put the goal on the shelf, philosophically speaking, and focus almost exclusively on the system. And I would define the system as the collection of daily habits that you follow and take you toward a particular goal. So ultimately, what we're looking for, of course, is to align the desired outcome, the goal, with your daily habits, the system. But whether you have the goal or not, and this is why I think it's so useful to focus on the system, your habits will carry you to a place, whether you want them to or not, right? And so I think, like, for example, a useful question to ask yourself is, can my current habits carry me to my desired future? And what you find is that a lot of the time they cannot. If you just keep repeating the same habits that you have today, will you end up where you want to end up? And what that is getting at, what that is showing you, is how much more powerful the system is than the goal. Whenever a system runs, it inevitably moves towards some destination. And what you want is to make sure that that destination is aligned with this system that you have, that your desired outcome and your daily habits are in alignment. But if they're not, the goal is not the thing that wins. If there's a difference between the system and the system always wins.
And just talking about habits and awareness, we often hear people talk about the downsides of habit because it indicates some sort of conditioning where we lose control over reactions. But in the book, you talk about building habits with awareness, and you refer to the pointing and calling system that the Japanese use in the train stations. Yeah. I found that absolutely fascinating and thought-provoking. So talk to us about this phenomenon and the implication for us in the way we think about cultivating habits. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I should pause and give you a context of where this question came from. On this podcast, I was speaking with Devdutt Patnaik, a thinker who draws lessons from mythology and talks about its application in daily life and in business. I happened to ask him about how we could build habits and what we could learn from mythology, and this is what he said.
See, this concept of habits is a Western idea. It comes Indian, you see, habit is a bad word in Indian philosophy. It's a bad word. Therefore, you are continuously, another word for habit is conditioned. I'm conditioned to do it. Conditioning, that's a Pavlovian response, right? A dog has a habit of salivating whenever the bell rings. And the West has made it a virtue. Action without thought is habit. Repetitive action without thought is habit. Indian thought is all about awareness. It's all about awareness. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you not doing what you're not doing? And once you're aware, then you realize what is of value to you and what is not of value to you. So you are not in a habit, then breaking habits becomes difficult. And then breaking habit becomes, there are good habits, there are bad habits. Habits are good and bad depending on context. You know, so you will find people behaving, that's why I always find, you know, when expats come to India, they have a tough time because the habit is suddenly in this new context, they don't know. Because, oh my God, there is no place to run. There is no place to, oh my God, they don't have this thing. Because the habit, right, they become the animal. You have become like an animal. And habit really goes to the lower part of your brain, not the upper part of your brain. And your habit is about avoiding life. You do habits like, it's an addiction.
It's like autopilot.
It's an autopilot. No, and it's addictive. Like, I have a habit of writing, but it's addiction. If I don't write, I get withdrawal symptoms, which means I've trained my body to be in pain when I don't do it and to get pleasure when I do it. And I'm not aware of it. I'm just doing it mechanically. So we are an awareness culture. Awareness, 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 not habit culture.
So as I was speaking with James Clear, who's arguably one of the leading thinkers in the field of building habits, I felt I should pressure test his thinking around habits and awareness. Now let's hear what James has to say.
Well, so the challenge, and I'll get to the story about the Japanese in a moment. The challenge is that in the beginning, a habit is, it's not, so the technical definition of a habit is a behavior that has been repeated enough times to be more or less automatic. So things that you can do without thinking, brushing your teeth, tying your shoes, etc. But in the beginning, when you're building a new habit, it does not occupy that automatic space. It's a very effortful, conscious thing. And so the problem is that because it's not our automatic response, the moment of action often passes us by. And that's for building a good habit. For changing our current habits, however, they do occupy that automatic space. There's something that we do. There's something that we do without even thinking about it a lot of the time. And because they are so automatic, we often perform them without even realizing it. We're done with the action before we even notice that we did that. Mm-hmm. And so there's this method, which is called pointing and calling, that I think helps raise our level of awareness about our current habits. And once we become aware of our habits, then we can change them. Then we can start to more meaningfully adjust them. So the story, and I actually saw this when I went to Tokyo. If you walk around Tokyo and go to a train station, what you'll see is this interesting pattern where when the train pulls into the station, the conductor will point at like a signal and say the signal is green, or they'll point at the speedometer and say speedometer is 30 kilometers an hour. Outside on the platform, other employees are doing similar things. They're pointing up and down the platform and they'll say platform is clear. The cleaning staff, even as they walk onto the train in between sessions to clean it off, take the trash out, and so on, they'll point at each car and, you know, say car is clean or trash is clear, things like that. And the purpose of this is that for anybody who does the same kind of job over and over again, like a train conductor pulling into the station, it becomes kind of automatic. That, you know, it becomes habitual. And so it's very easy to overlook your mistakes. And so by pointing and calling, by literally physically pointing and saying out loud what you're doing, you're raising the level of awareness of the action. And you people don't use the phrase pointing and calling, but you can see them do this kind of thing all the time in daily life. So, for example, I have a friend who, she'll leave the garage door up accidentally sometimes. And so now every time she pulls out of her garage, she points at the door and says, garage door is down. Or when you're getting ready to go on a trip or leave your house for a few days, you might double check everything and say, I have my keys, I have my glasses, I have my wallet. And you're like touching them in your pockets while you're doing that. And so those are all examples of pointing and calling to try to double check, to raise the awareness, to be aware, more aware of what we're doing. And if you want, you can actually use that same strategy when you're trying to build or break habits. So, for example, if you want to stop snacking, when you reach into the cupboard to get out a cookie or go to the pantry to get out a snack, you could say, I'm about to eat this cookie and I don't want to because I'm trying to stop snacking. And just the act of saying that out loud before you do it might be enough to prevent you from it. It sounds silly. It sounds a little like over the top to do it. It can be a very useful strategy early on so that you become more aware of your behavior.
The other big theme you talk about in the book, James, is the fact that environment matters more than motivation, right? And I found that fascinating in the context of the electronic devices that often consume our attention. Talk to us a little bit about the crux of the insight here, but more specifically how that plays out in the way, for example, we think about our phone home screen, for example.
Yeah. So environment is a huge driver of our habits and behavior. I think perhaps the most overlooked driver of them, because we're constantly surrounded by an environment. And so a lot of the time we don't even think about it. But the items that are on your desk at work, the things on your kitchen counter at home, the way your living room is laid out, all of those environments influence and shape your habits to a certain degree. And the same is true for your digital environment. So the icons that are on your home screen, or the way that your desktop is laid out, or what tabs you have open on your web browser, all of those are pieces of the digital environment that nudge and shape and suggest certain habits and behaviors to you. So there are a variety of things that you can do to try to optimize the environment to build better habits. But the big picture idea is you want to make the cues, the reminders, the triggers of your good habits more obvious and make the cues of your bad habits less obvious, less visible. So for example, if you want to watch TV less, you could put it inside a wall unit or a cabinet so that it's behind doors and it's hidden a little bit more. If you want to snack less, you can put those snacks in the highest shelf in the pantry or in a room or a closet that you rarely open. Meanwhile, if you want to eat healthier foods, you can place those in a bowl that's like very visible on the counter. When I wanted to start flossing consistently, I would brush my teeth twice a day, but I would only floss every now and then. And so I got a little bowl and I put it right next to my toothbrush on the sink so that I could see it. I brushed my teeth, put the toothbrush down, picked the floss up. That was basically all I needed to do to actually build that habit. I already wanted to do it. It just was tucked away in a drawer most of the time. And by making it more visible in the environment, I increased the odds that I was going to follow through. So the first thing you can do is kind of increase the visibility. And you can also do that with your phone. For example, when I wanted to build a reading habit, I moved Pocket and Audible, which are two. Pocket lets you save articles to read for later, and Audible is for audiobooks. I put those right on the home screen in the home bar, so they were two of the first apps that I would see every time I opened my phone. And so I made that app more visible, which increased the odds that I was going to perform the reading habit. The second thing you can do to shape the environment to kind of nudge or improve your habits is to either increase the number of steps between you and the bad behavior or decrease the number of steps between you and the good behavior. So basically, you want to make the good habit the path of least resistance. As an example, I had one reader who he would practice guitar and then he'd come back from his guitar session, put the guitar in a case and put it in the closet. And so he just wouldn't see it for like a week and then he'd forget to practice. But so his new habit became, I'll take my guitar, put it on a stand in the middle of the living room, pass it all the time. It's right there. It's very obvious. It's also frictionless to just pick it up and play for 5 minutes. And so now he practices all the time because it's highly visible. You can also increase the friction of a task. So for example, if you wanted to watch less TV, you could take the batteries out of the remote control so you have to get up to turn it on manually. Or you could unplug the TV after each use and only plug it back in if you can say the name of the show that you want to watch. So it's now, you know, you can't just like mindlessly turn on and find something. And those are examples of kind of increasing the friction or reducing the friction associated with the habit. And the lower the friction is, the more convenient it is, the more likely a habit will be performed. And the higher the friction is, the more inconvenient it is, the less likely you're going to fall into that habit. And so those two strategies, increasing visibility and increasing convenience by reducing friction, those are two good ways to build good habits and restructure your environment so that those habits are kind of fostered rather than hindered.
Got it. And just as we wrap up this conversation, James, you also talk about the notion of a two-minute rule or a gateway habit that often is the sort of the door that opens us into a path of building multiple other habits. So talk to us a little bit about the concept here, why this is important, and what are some of the gateway habits that you see people using to build other habits?
Yeah, this is a great place to finish because the two-minute rule, I think, is a really good place to start. If you're looking for one takeaway, what should I do with this information? This is a really good place to start. So the two-minute rule says, take whatever habit you're trying to build and scale it down to something that takes 2 minutes or less to do. So read 40 books a year becomes read one page, or do yoga 4 days a week becomes take out my yoga mat. And sometimes when I say that, people resist it a little bit because they're like, okay, I know the real goal isn't just to take my yoga mat out. Like, I know I actually want to do the workout. So if it's this mental trick and I know it's a trick, like, why would I fall for it? And if you feel that way, I understand that, but I would suggest for the first day or the first week, actually force yourself to stop after 2 minutes. So I tell the story of a reader named Mitch. I mentioned this in the book. And he ended up losing a lot of weight, 100 pounds. So what was that? Probably, 40 kilograms, something like that. And when he went to the gym for the first time, he wasn't allowed to stay for longer than 5 minutes. So he would show up at the gym, work out for, do half an exercise, get back in the car, drive home. And it sounds silly, right? It sounds ridiculous because you're like, this is not going to get the guy the results that he wants. But what you realize if you step back is that he was mastering the art of showing up. He was becoming the type of person that went to the gym 4 days a week, even if it was only for 5 minutes. And this, I think, is a much deeper truth about habits that's often overlooked, which is a habit must be established before it can be improved, right? You have to make it the standard in your life, make it the new normal before you can worry about optimizing it or expanding it from there. And so often we're focused on finding the perfect business idea, the best workout program, the ideal diet plan. We're so focused on optimizing that we don't give ourselves permission to show up, even if it's just in a small way. But if you can't master the art of showing up, there's no raw material to work with. There's nothing to optimize. And so the 2-minute rule really helps you get over that hurdle. It helps you master the art of showing up, start building a habit, even if it's small. And then you have somewhere to gain a foothold. Then you have something to push off of and expand into. And for that reason, I think it's a really valuable strategy to use when you're trying to get started with a new habit.
Got it. James, we could go on for another 1 hour on this. There's so much to explore, but I'm mindful of time. So thank you so much for making time on the podcast, James, and really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. As we embark on a journey in 2020, trust this gave you some thoughts to mull over as you go about baking habits and building systems. I also realize that this is a topic that's easy to get cognitively, but difficult to implement in daily life. But I think there's a lot we can learn from people's stories and struggles around some of these themes. So here's a suggestion. Why don't we learn from each other and raise our game? So I'm going to share three questions, or three topics rather, and I want you to email your response. Please email your response to deepakj.p2p@transitioninsight.com. I will spell it out. DEEPAKJ dot the alphabet P, the number 2, the alphabet P, at transitioninsight, TransitionInsight.com, with the subject stories around habits. I will anonymize the stories and share what I collect with the people that write in, and hopefully we can learn from each other. And the three topics you could write about are: 1, appointing and calling system that has worked for you in conducting a habit with awareness. 2, a 2-minute rule or a gateway habit that might have worked for you in a certain context. And 3, a situation where you had to grind through the plateau of latent potential. I repeat, the three topics are: 1, appointing and calling system that's worked for you in conducting a habit with awareness. 2, a 2-minute rule or a gateway habit that might have worked for you in a certain context. And 3, a situation where you had to grind through the plateau of latent potential. Do use the subject stories around habits and send the email to deepakj.p2p@transitioninsight.com. If you're deriving value for the content and want to show your gratitude to the podcast, I request you to consider paying it forward by contributing to an organization that I support, Antarang Foundation. It helps thousands of young children from challenging backgrounds play to their unique potential. Please visit the Pay It Forward section at playtopotential.com to know more. Signing off, this is Deepak Jayaraman. To know more about the advisory work I do, please visit the About the Host section at playtopotential.com. Have a wonderful 2020 and look forward to you tuning into some of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.